$1 billion out of their budget, and that had the effect of proposing the closure of 48 state parks,
including a lot of North Coast parks,
including quite a few North Coast parks. And then in May of 2009, when the same governor proposed closing 220 state parks, it was to take, in fact, almost all but not quite all of the general fund away. I mean, there was an order of magnitude impact to state parks that wasn't just when they went up in the cut. They weren't just adding a few more parks. They were actually closing over 80% of the system. You know, legislative analysts came out recently and said there's a $26 billion hole facing this new governor and the new legislature. So our challenge here is to stop chasing an eroding tide as much as we can and figure out, all right, between a mix of public resources, because these are public goods that need to be supported, how do we find the minimum amount of funding that the state has been giving to just keep the lights on, keep the gates open, keep the rangers in place to help provide safety in parks, and then say, okay, if we're going to consider that there may continue to be some cuts and we're going to have to see some closures or some partial closures like we've seen here in 2010, how do we find ways through nonprofit organizations, volunteer groups, that type of thing, to try to keep these parks available to us? Because I don't think many of us on our watch want to say we were the last generation that had access to California state parks. That's not what these were set aside for. That's not what we've been the beneficiaries of. We've got work to do to say, okay, we've got to keep these places open for today, but what we're really about is preserving a legacy for tomorrow, too.
Thank you, Tracy. Any closing thoughts?
Well, I think that, you know, if there is a silver lining to you know, the outcome of Prop 21, although we didn't get the measure to pass, I think we did see an outpouring of Californians who want to see their parks open and they want to see them accessible, and we're going to be capitalizing on that. You know, more than 3.5 million voted for Prop 21, and we're going to be counting on those 3.5 million Californians to keep making sure that their voices are heard.
And we'll keep doing what we can to make sure they hear your voice.
Great.
Thanks very much. That was Tracy Virardo-Torres, the Vice President for Government Affairs at the California State Parks Foundation. Our next segment is with Karen Schombach. Karen is the coordinator of the California PEER, Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility. Welcome to Eco News Report, Karen.
Thank you, Scott.
So, Karen, we've been talking with other folks about the threat to public resources and natural resources, especially in California, that comes from budget cuts, basically, and the failure of California agencies to safeguard natural resources. I've been talking with Tracy Virardo-Torres from the California State Parks Foundation about threats to state parks, and with Rob DiPerna, EPIC's industrial forestry advocate, about the cuts to the Department of Fish and Game's Timber Harvest Plan Review Program that basically eliminated that program. From your perspective in the Sierras, Karen, what's it look like on both these fronts, to state parks and to forests that are regulated by the state?
Well, I'll start with the state parks. The cuts to the state parks budget are obviously going to have some terrible on-the-ground effects in our state parks. We hear about they're not going to be able to buy toilet paper. I'm afraid that's probably the least of the things we need to worry about. Cutting back on staff means there's no rangers to protect the natural or cultural resources in those parks.
And when we say cutting back, we should probably make it clear that the baseline is not a good one. I mean, one park I'm familiar with that we've talked about a lot, the Tolowa Dunes State Park, has been working with essentially a 1/6 of a ranger for many years.
Right, and the state park's deferred maintenance is, I think it's like around $1 billion, if I'm not mistaken. I'd have to...
That sounds about right.
Does that sound right? Yeah, I know. And that was as of 2 or 3 years ago. I think they stopped counting then, but given the budget for the last couple of years, I think we can safely assume that deferred maintenance is even more than that now. So, yeah, our state parks are not in... Things aren't looking very good for them.
So what's this mean for the public employees that PEER speaks for? I mean, when those guys are trying to do their jobs and protect public resources and they don't have the money to replace themselves or do basic jobs, how do these budget stresses change the situation for employees on the ground, for the kind of folks you work with as coordinator for the Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility?
Well, first of all, they're not on the ground as much. You know, the furloughs, which, of course, all state employees are experiencing, means that they don't have the presence that they did. And, you know, it depends on the state park. Some are experiencing They're staffing cuts. They're shorter hours in the parks, which means that you don't have the interpretive programs. You don't have the maintenance. You don't have rangers taking care of natural resources. You see shortcuts, the environmental documentation that needs to be done on projects. You have parks that are allowing their roads to deteriorate because they don't have the funds to maintain them. You know, just all the things that you would expect if you have a park without anybody there to take care of it.
You're listening to the EcoNews Report. This is Scott Greeson, Executive Director of EPIC, and I'm talking with Karen Schombach, the California Coordinator for the Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility. So, Karen, we've been talking about state parks and their very serious challenges. Another aspect of the threats to public resources in California that we began the show with today is essentially the elimination of the Department of Fish and Game's review of industrial logging proposals. What's that mean for the Sierras especially?
Well, it probably means more clear cutting without the review for impacts to fish and wildlife resources. You know, it's ironic. I don't know, you probably remember, Scott, back around 2000, 2001, we had the exact situation where the budget had not allowed for fish and game positions for reviewing timber harvest plans in the Sierra Nevada. And we had a kind of a clear-cutting free-for-all going on. And there was a huge public outcry, and those positions were restored. And to see them being cut again is just outrageous. It's just outrageous because nobody's looking out for fish and game, fish and wildlife, in reviewing these Sierra timber harvest plans. And that doesn't mean that the timber harvest plans don't keep rolling through. They are. They're just doing it without any kind of anybody looking out for how they're going to affect wildlife.
Mm-hmm. It used to be that you had to fly, you know, you had to get up in an airplane to really get a good view of the magnitude of the clear cuts, especially in the Sierras that, you know, forest advocates like you, Karen, are having to deal with. These days, anybody with a computer and a little bit of time can look at Google Earth and Google Maps and get a rough idea of what's going on. And, you know, having done that recently, the idea that we're going to have more clear-cutting in the Sierras is a little challenging. I mean, where are they going to go?
Well, that's true. And, you know, what you can't see on Google Earth or when you're flying is the ownership pattern. So there's, you know, what they call the checkerboard of national forest lands intermingled with private holdings, which these days are primarily Sierra Pacific Industries. And so when you look at the amount, I mean, you could almost see the checkerboarding from the Google map. And, yeah, you do wonder, you know, how much further can they go? But, you know, I don't think it's any secret that we know that Sierra Pacific intended to convert its holdings to plantations, and that's what they're doing.
When we learned of the cuts to the Department of Fish and Game's timber review program, one of the first comments we saw on it was the observation from a legislative staffer that this was a Christmas present to Sierra Pacific Industries. How's that true, and what's that mean from your perspective, Karen?
Well, I think it's absolutely true. I mean, it relieves Sierra Pacific of the burden of having to consider wildlife resources when they do their timber harvest plans.
One Department of Fish and Game staffer I talked to about this said, you know, the hard truth is basically that if we're not there, there's going to be backsliding and we're not going to be there. Any comment on that?
Well, no. I mean, I think that's exactly right. I mean, even when they were there, it was a challenge to get SBI to meet its obligations to protect fish and wildlife. And frankly, I think in a lot of cases, fish and wildlife were not properly protected because, you know, the bias built into the, you know, CDF's program, California Department of Forestry, gives deference to the, you know, to the industry. And without fish and game there, I shudder to think what they'll get away with.
Really appreciate your time today, Karen. Any closing thoughts?
No, except that, you know, I hope that the budget being reconsidered will include finding some money for, you know, taking better care of these resources that make California the wonderful place it is.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a common thread I've heard through all of these interviews today is that very small changes make a very big difference to the natural resources.
Yep, that's true.
Okay. Thanks so much.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Thanks.
All right. So this has been the EcoNews Report. My name is Scott Greeson, and I've been your host for the past half hour. My guests today, again, have been Rob DiPerna of EPIC, Tracy Verardo-Torres from the California State Parks Foundation, and Karen Schombach of PEER, Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility. You can find more information about EPIC at wildcalifornia.org, about California State Parks Foundation at calparks.org, and about PEER at peer.org. If you'd like to replay this interview or share it with others, you can go to the public affairs page on the KHSU website at khsu.org, where these programs are archived for 2 weeks after they air. Thereafter, the files from recent shows are posted on the North Coast Environmental Center's website at yournec.org. If you have any questions or comments about this program, please call KHSU's listener comment line at 826-6089. The EcoNews Report is produced for KHSU, located at Humboldt State University, in cooperation with the North Coast Environmental Center. Many thanks to Fred McLaughlin for engineering. And join us again next Thursday at 1:30 here on KHSU for the EcoNews Report.
Santa Cruz, the rock of the Monterey Bay.
Hey man, what's up? Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3, this is Earth Mommer.
Enter girl.
Arr.
Santa Cruz. Arr, pirate radio in the house.
Good idea!
Coming to a transmitter near you.
A is a J that will live in infamosity.
96.3 Pirate Radio Station, Santa Cruz, in your fucking ear hole.
The future of radio is here.
By listening to this free radio station, you have joined millions of other people in hundreds of cities, suburbs, and small towns across this country and around the world who have chosen to listen to the call for freedom on the airwaves.
Hello!
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 More stimulating rock radio.
Wow! Hi, we're the Teen Angels.
And you're listening to 96.3.
Yeah!
Very good. Tune us in on the World Wide Web at www.microradio.net/FRSC.
Somehow, this is not what God had in mind.
Oh, good God Almighty me. I think he's the Antichrist.
Go!
We're gonna be pirates!
Skipping. P.O. Box 7507, Santa Cruz, California 95061.
And coming up next on Free Radio, Bathrobs, Piers, Broadsides, the Eternal Endless Thanksgiving Special. Stay tuned.
Family's
crying. Crying. Crying.
And that was the first two cuts from American Idiot. American Idiot and Jesus of Suburbia, or actually, sorry, Jesus of Suburbia and City of the Damned, I think. A little unclear from the CD back cover. You're tuned to Free Radio 101.1 FM, as you probably noticed from the cool precursor to this show, all the different snazzy and jazzy Free Radio Santa Cruz introductions and sign-ins and so forth. I wish I had a cool sign-in. Perhaps someone can step forward and volunteer to do one for me. This is, again, 101.1 FM, www.freakradio. It's Thanksgiving, November 25th, 2010. And it looks like nobody's around. Uncle Dennis is normally does the next show, From the Cream to the Dregs, is going to be away doing goodness knows what, probably some questionable behavior with his family up north. And we'll be playing some probably some golden oldies. He's got a Thanksgiving special he's prepared, so in his absence, you'll be able to catch his artistry. I was at the Thanksgiving meal today. That's the one that's usually held at the Vets Hall, but because the county shut down the Vets Hall in opposition to two engineering studies produced by the veterans groups themselves, refused to open it for the last year or to provide adequate facilities. That's a decision by the courts about a week ago. Yeah, I think last week it was. The meal was sort of hastily moved to the Civic Auditorium. I think they weren't even going to do it this year, but the renowned Steve Plaich, who ran for city council and has been a frequent co-host, or at least sometime guest-slash-co-host on the show, stepped into the breaches along with Pastor Dennis Adams and numerous other luminaries, Joe Schultz. And they cooked up a dinner for, well, there were 500 people who had come by mid-meal, which is about half as many, I think, as came last year to the Vets Hall. And some of us were speculating, why was that so? Is it because the number of people has dropped, as some claim, in terms of the number of homeless people or the number of hungry people? I kind of doubt that, really. Is it because people don't know where to go because they'd heard the Vets Hall was closed, or they knew the Vets Hall was closed, or they went to the Vets Hall and found it was closed and there was no indication there? I don't know if somebody actually put up a sign, as Vision Song Valerie suggested be done. One of the local homeless activists here. Probably there was a sign put up, I imagine, by somebody. Or, you know, there's a lot of... Presumably there's a certain buzz around the town. If you want to get food, you can go to the Civic Auditorium. And there was quite a long line around noon, stretched to the end of the block and partway down the block, down Center Street. But far shorter a line than I'd seen at the Vets Hall on Christmas and Thanksgiving's past. So not really clear what's going on. We set up a table there. Crow, that's Mike Liebeck, his court name, since he'll be going to court charged with sleeping illegally, this time a misdemeanor because he was charged with the state anti-lodging law and the protests that Peace Camp 2010 held this year at City Hall and at the county building. And we did some tabling. We had some petitions out there against the sleeping ban and in favor of dropping prosecutions for the Peace Camp 2010 defendants, which I encourage people listening to this show to take some action on. You can, I don't know if you can do it now because I suspect offices are closed and they don't have answering machines, but they're... District Attorney's Office, I believe, I'm not sure if it's going to be open tomorrow, but we had the petition to drop charges against Peace Camp 2010. We, the undersigned, urge Santa Cruz to immediately drop all charges against the homeless and housed protesters who lawfully vigiled for 3 months in a public protest at the county building and City Hall. Dozens of people are charged variously with sleeping at night outside. That's a city code. That's the sleeping ban. Covering up with blankets at night, that's the city code, that's the blanket ban. Being in a closed area, that's the protest ban, where they closed the city hall and the library benches in order to discourage protesters from being there at night, even though there was no criminal activity happening other than sleeping. Obstructing the sidewalk, which didn't happen, but people were charged with it, and lying down on the sidewalk, which actually is an ordinance that doesn't apply in the City Hall area, but the police inappropriately used it anyway. Too bad somebody didn't simply take an arrest and then sue them for false arrest, big time. I really don't like it when city authorities collude to try to shut down protests, particularly protests that I feel are overdue, important, to the point, and concern human rights issues of some of the most vulnerable people, and particularly protests that I'm involved with, of course. Anyway, the petition continues, these were part of a coordinated campaign to end the peaceful and legal protest at night outside the county building and city hall. Available emergency walk-in shelter is there for less than 140 beds for a population of 1,000 plus. Looks like that's a somewhat garbled sentence, but you catch the gist. Community activists should not be punished for raising this issue visibly as they did last summer. And I'm going to put this petition, hopefully with a few ungarbling corrections, online so people can continue to sign it. And it'll be presented, of course, to the new shitty council, which will be convening second Tuesday in December. And I guess that's when Rotkin goes out and presumably Ryan Coonerty, who I saw today at the Thanksgiving meal, along with his father, the supervisor, Neil Coonerty, and their co-conspirator, council member Lynn Robinson, all pretty bad on homeless issues, though I'm sure they like to pride themselves on being pretty good. It's kind of ironic. Catherine Byers is also stepping about. She's a council member who, ironically, is probably one of the most liberal council members, but, of course, she doesn't vote liberal when the chips are down, generally. She votes with the majority for the anti-homeless laws, such as making 3 unattended sleeping ban tickets a jailing crime, such as creating a situation where if you have 3 unattended tickets that is for sleeping, that becomes any tickets thereafter of any kind for any infractions become misdemeanors and jailing crimes, such as not speaking out at all about the crackdown on protesters this summer and not speaking up for a sensible, honest, at least L.A.-style Jones settlement-type solution to the Santa Cruz civil rights problem around the homeless, which would say if somebody is outside and sleeping and doing nothing other than sleeping, then if there's no shelter bed, you don't arrest that person, cite that person, or even bother that person. And you can find that issue out by simply calling the homeless service center and asking if the city's shelter provider has shelter. If they don't, you leave them alone. And that was proposed repeatedly by us and by activist Ed Fry, who stood up at the Peace Camp 2010, who actually was one of the founders, probably the initiator of Peace Camp 2010, along with other Huff and homeless activists, way back in July, and provided a porta potty. He went even further. He said it doesn't matter if there are shelter beds. The question is whether the person sleeping outside is a health and safety problem, violates someone else's rights. It's not a question of whether you can create an excuse to throw people into a concentration camp situation at night where they may get ill because they're all being shoved together under conditions that normal people would violate the health and safety laws. In fact, in New York, they had to change the health and safety laws to allow for homeless shelters in the 70s. And it led one critic to talk about homeless shelters as essentially being homeless people aren't really homeless. They are displaced urban residents. That's really what's happened. The rent profiteering, the destruction of available housing, the outsourcing of jobs has created a situation where more and more people are homeless or living in makeshift situations like garages, vehicles, and so forth, which was also an issue at the last city council, the rental inspection ordinance, which I think Don Lame, council member Don Lame, who I call Gon Lame because of his early record of fleeing from homeless issues after initially presenting claims he was going to stand up for homeless people way back in 1988 when he first ran for and was successful at making city council office. Lane admitted that the reason that we have this rental inspection ordinance, which introduces fines and fees for all the landlords who are renting anything out, they have to provide for inspections, self-inspect, or allow inspectors on their premises. All this is happening when there's a backlog of complaints about I think it's 50 back complaints about inappropriate housing that haven't been even inspected or investigated by the city staff. Lane admitted that the reason for this law was that they wanted to make more money to pay for the inspectors. It seems to me that this should have been admitted up front and all the rest of the excuses dropped. Maybe they should have put on the ballot a revenue measure that said we need to pay for inspectors to go out there and make sure that those houses, rooms, rental situations that have received complaints get appropriate consideration and that the landlords be forced to bring those units up to habitability standards of the 50 complaints that were out there. Instead, new conditions are being set, new demands are being made, and the concern of a lot of renters and landlords is that there's going to be a situation where people are just going to have to abandon housing because it's not going to be up to the rental inspection standards, even though the tenants aren't complaining. And there's a mixed bag here. I mean, tenants have a right to decent housing, but in Santa Cruz, what they really have a right to is some kind of rent control, rent stabilization, or at least eviction protection, all of which has never been put forward by Rotkin or Matthews or, for that matter, any of the even more liberal city council people who were elected in 1998, Crone, Fitzmaurice, and Sugar, none of whom have survived into office, and all of whom kind of turned their backs on homeless people once they reached office, which is not an unusual situation, although it doesn't happen in bigger cities like San Francisco, where there continue to be supervisors in San Francisco. The city and county are the same, so they don't have a city council. They just have a board of supervisors. And they have supervisors who actually stand up and say no to measures like Measure L, which passed somewhat narrowly at the last election. That's the San Francisco's version of Santa Cruz's don't sit on the sidewalks near buildings law, although in San Francisco it was more sweeping in terms of being citywide, not just in business districts, although more limited in terms of being applicable only during business hours or during kind of, I think it's 7 to 10 or 11, I'm not quite sure, but it's not 24 hours. In Santa Cruz, if you sit near a building at any time of the day or night, that's, I think it's $150 to $250 citation. Particularly if you say, hey, leave me alone, I'm just sitting here. When the host, false alarm security guard, or SCPD mock cop comes up. I say mock cop because I don't think these kind of behaviors by police show any respect for real law and real justice and real fairness, and they are a form of sort of merchant goon squad activity. And I find that objectionable. Anyway, that's the petition. There was a petition to drop charges against Peace Camp 2010, which I'm going to be hopefully putting online. We had a second petition, again, urging the city council to end the sleeping ban, mostly because we have absolutely zero chance of getting the city council even put this on their agenda, I'm quite sure. However, to show the sentiment of the community, I think it's important. And it was interesting. We didn't get an overwhelming number of signatures, but a lot of people who weren't even asked stopped at our table, signed, and we were able to, I think we got a really favorable reception from a lot of people. That doesn't mean anybody's going to get active. It doesn't mean we have anywhere near the organization or impetus to proceed to actually start doing the kinds of protest, legal and extra-legal activity that would, I think, make ending the sleeping ban a real prospect, and ending the criminalization of the homeless and the criminalization of poverty, which is what we really need to do, closer to our agenda, or closer to, you know, fruition. Still, it was encouraging to see, and for that reason alone, I kind of have poo-pooed Steve Plaich's involvement in setting up this homeless, this Thanksgiving meal at the vets, that the vets essentially sort of stepped away from, because they said, look, you know, you've destroyed a community center, you've kicked the vets out of their hall, and now you want us to go run over to the Civic and cook something over there because you want to keep us out of the, and the whole community out of the vets, you know, vets hall. I think that's, you know, that's something they weren't prepared to do. But Steve, some weeks ago decided, and I think probably not only with good motivation, but I think to some extent with good consequence, that it was important to have this meal, first of all, because it feeds people, and feeding people is a good thing. Second of all, well, for me, the reason I decided it was a good thing when I was there is because I noticed people got together in a form of community. I mean, some of it was bullshit, you know, smile, hello, we're glad to see you, we'll shake your hand. And they weren't being phony, but the idea of a one-day compassion activity always makes me, well, I feel sarcastic about it. I feel dissatisfied with it. I feel it's a form, really, of feel-good activity for middle-class people who want to feel they're doing something good one or two days a year. And it's not that they shouldn't do something. It makes them feel good. And it isn't that what they do doesn't do some good for people. Serving food is a good thing. But the idea that this somehow addresses any real issues other than provides one or two meals a year is hogwash. And I don't, of course, nobody's really claiming that, but the amount of energy that's put into an event like this, if, you know, a 15th of this amount of energy were put into changing the laws of Santa Cruz or empowering homeless people on a more daily basis, it would be a much better thing. And my focus has always been on ending the criminalization of poor people. Some people focus on decent social services, decent medical, dental care, you know, access to housing and jobs. And these are important things, too. And indeed, once a year, they have their little project. Not little, fairly. It was a very big Project Connect, which happened in the same building, the Civic Auditorium, back in February, similar to what they did in San Francisco. But this is done by the same people who the rest of the year turn a blind eye to the conditions under which homeless people suffer in terms of how they're abused by police and discriminated against by merchants and other people downtown, who have created a tripwire network of laws that criminalize poor people down there. And it's just a sad thing. as far as I'm concerned. But I did pick up some interviews, and I'm actually going to pick up my street interview dissemination from where I left off. And I believe I was interviewing Catman. Robert is his first name, another Robert. And there was a third Robert. It was a friend of Catman's from, I think, one of the hotels at the Palomar or the St. George. And Catman had been assaulted in apparently a mistaken identity situation by a couple of middle-class youths, because Catman had been trying to recover money that I think, ironically, a homeless-looking woman had stolen. And he thought she'd stolen, and maybe she had, and I think he said he had, and presumably she had. And this all developed into a confusing situation where he got beaten up by these guys and, you know, had to have stitches in his eye and so forth. And we talked about it on the street, and I played that last Thursday. Last Sunday, I believe it was. I also have a show on Sunday. And on today, on every Thursday, I do a show at night. And here's the rest of that conversation.
How long have you lived, Robert, on Pacific Avenue?
I've lived here 10 years.
And
this is the Robert is a friend of the Catman.
Has the avenue changed at all, and if so, how?
Not in the last 10 years, not at all. It's been the same as far as I know. I used to come here 20 years ago, and it was a little bit more like hippie/yuppie. Now it's more like kind of like cosmopolitan.
And how's the Palomar management treat its tenants?
Awesome. It's really good people. Palomar people, they're on top of everything.
The police department treating you?
Police department, they do their job. They're good people. They're good. I joined the force.
Have you ever been able to use them for a particular crime prevention or solution problem?
Of course. I work at a hotel. I used to work at a hotel on the beach and boardwalk, and there's a lot of drug activity there. And they were there promptly to handle the situation very professionally. Very professional.
Anything other than drug activity, like any violent crimes that you've been involved with or you've seen the police involved with?
I know that as far as the system is concerned, they're compassionate, and their ruling is, they're not harsh. I used to live in Monterey County, and over there they're very, I don't know, I think they overuse their force there. Here in Santa Cruz, they're a little more compassionate, and I think they're more fair, and they follow the guidelines, I think, more austerely.
Thank you, Robert. Anything you want to add?
No, thank you.
Anything else, Catman?
Yeah, man. We need to keep this place at nighttime the same as it is in the daytime. In the daytime, it's nice and peaceful. And it looks like everybody's getting along. And I know for a fact that some of these people don't even like each other. But they're civilized. And they don't bring it out in public.
Thank you, Kevin. We're talking with Gabe. And Gabe, you're I first met you way back in 2003 when you were demonstrating against the war. Then you went and joined the military, confusing everybody. And now you're back and you have some comments on the Vets Hall controversy, which yesterday, or actually the day before yesterday, the courts decided that the vets have in fact been inappropriately and negligently treated by the county. I'm not quite clear that that's actually a ruling that they have to open the Vets Hall, which they should and should have done months ago. But nonetheless, there was a favorable ruling that will be coming up in January again for settlement, and maybe even before then if it's settled privately. But you noticed something that I think it was the district attorney. You said city attorney, but I think it was the district attorney, because it's a county issue, so it wouldn't have been the city attorney, I would think. A comment he made in Curtis Alexander's article in the Sentinel.
Yeah, he said to the judge or jury, whichever it had been, to not allow emotional concern for veterans to cloud their judgment in the case.
Exonerating a guilty county behavior. Now, you're a vet yourself.
Right.
Now, have you been using the Veterans Administration to any good? Have you had any benefits from them? How are they treating you?
Well, since I've been back in Santa Cruz, the Vets Hall has been closed the entire time, so I'm one of the many that has to catch the bus up to Palo Alto. It picks up at like 7 in the morning and stay until 4 in the afternoon to catch it back to get here at like 6 in the afternoon, for regardless of how short of you actually need to be up there. It's an all-day event no matter what.
And what kind of service? Doesn't Emma Line provide some services now?
It's nearly nothing. The county representatives and the services that are provided since the vet hall got closed is nearly nothing. I mean,
were they providing the services that you received in Palo Alto now previously at the Veterans Hall, or did you have to take the bus up there then from the Veterans Hall?
No, I mean, I don't even know what it was like to have the Vets Hall open is what I was getting at.
You weren't really sure.
No, yeah, since I've been back, it's been closed, which has been interesting, to say the least, to not have any, like, distinct representation anywhere in Santa Cruz County for the most part.
Well, let me ask you the most important question. Have you been arrested for illegally sitting on the sidewalk?
Not in a while.
Or ticketed, perhaps?
No, it's been a bit.
Is this because you have avoided that uncomfortable butt-on-the-cement approach, or because the police have not been snappy enough to catch you?
I try to keep my scheming and plotting to the shadows.
So you've abandoned your high-profile, down-and-dirty, out-in-public approach?
For the most part.
Any sense of any changes in Santa Cruz in the last 7 years since you were doing a public protest against the war and in favor of the homeless, I might add?
A lot, really. I mean, a lot, and then in another light, not a whole lot, but I mean, the biggest change that I've noticed is just the attitudes of people. A lot of the locals seem more jaded. Most of the street communities, I don't know, the rising influence of methamphetamine, I should say, has gotten insane. And it's a different climate, that's for sure. There's a lot less love out there.
How about the police? Any change there?
Not really. I think that they've always been the way they are, and they'll continue to be that way. I mean, for the most part, they're what they are. Some of them better than others, some of them worse. But a necessary evil until we decide to take responsibility for our own actions.
We've been talking with the old philosopher, I should say, the young philosopher.
Gabe.
Thanks, Gabe. So we're talking with
Sean.
And Sean, you got a good report from the street. We're here at the San Lorenzo footbridge.
We just met this guy walking to the shelter the other day. He gave us some socks. It's Socks for Souls. He gives out sleeping bags and for the poor, shoes, and other things, too, I think he can do. Special requests he can ask for. His name's Will. His number's 430-8162. He's a pretty awesome dude. And he, my wife called him. He was there in, like, less than a half an hour with sleeping bags for people. So, you know.
Wow. So he responded.
Yeah, he's a cool guy.
Huh. Any hassles with police? Anything you want to report?
They've been rolling thick. They've been, they've been harassing everyone.
No,
open containers, but also just they've been riding everyone at the beach here. I mean, they rode through like 6 times the other day, you know?
Any tickets or...
Yeah, my wife got a ticket the other day.
What'd you get a ticket for?
For a container that wasn't hers. It was against a tree.
Sitting near a container, eh?
Sitting near a container.
And...
An open container. You got a ticket.
Now, you, of course, you're under 21, right?
I'm way over.
So as an adult, you have to wait until you're 48 to be able to drink. You know that.
Yeah, you know. I was sitting near a container and they got me.
They told us to go to a bar.
Did you ask them for, I don't know, the cost of 2 drinks? And
it's just like, you know, why? Every other country you can... You know, as long as you're responsible, you know. We're not selling meth, we're having a beer, you know what I mean?
Are there particular police officers you find better than others?
Guys, clear the way, please.
There's always those who got beaten up in high school who, you know, want to retaliate. I mean, there's always going to be, yeah, of course there is.
You know? Any particular you wish to mention?
No. I don't really know the officer's name. We've only been here a short time, but there's a black-haired cop who's pretty cool. He's always been... I don't have any
husband, you're going to have to carry me here in a minute.
But, you know, it's about growing up, isn't it? It's like the officers who know what's going on are cool.
Any hassles for camping or sleeping?
We haven't. We moved.
We're over here.
Yeah. But you got to keep moving around. You know, we got harassed at the pier the other day. But they were cool. They didn't bother us all weekend. But then, you know, as soon as the Monday came.
We've been talking with Sean. Thanks, Sean, and thank you, Sean Associate. Now for broadcast, just some notes. Here's a fantasy about a course I might teach as a professor.
We'll leave those fantasies for another time. As you can see, I often leave a few notes on my ongoing tapes. It's not that sometimes these aren't interesting, but they're not really necessarily in keeping with the subject matter of our broadcast. In case you want to call in with your fantasies and notes or your reactions to what's going on here or what's happening on Thanksgiving or, as I say, Turkey Slaughter Day, as I like to describe it, please do. The call-in number here is 427-3772, 427-3772. If you're out of the area, our area code is 831, 831-427-3772. Let's hear a little bit more of American Idiot, and then this particular American Idiot will be back with you.
Thank you.
And that was another one from American Idiot. Here's a little something from in honor of the Thanksgiving Day festivities. Native American Day of Mourning in Plymouth, Massachusetts. Let's see if we can get this sucker online here.
Hello, I'm Matt Cale, and on behalf of Expert Village, I'm here today to tell you all about the history of Thanksgiving. What we currently celebrate as Thanksgiving has gone through a lot of changes since it was first celebrated in the early 1600s, or was it? How we actually remember history can be very different than how the real events occurred. What'll become a small little battle in history will become a war with 100 years and how people will remember it and how many people allegedly fought and died on each side. Something similar here can happen with observances and holidays. With Thanksgiving is, there's turkey and there's family and friends traveling all around. There are football games on, there are parades. If you go back to the origins of Thanksgiving, a lot of this had little or nothing to do with the original observance and holiday, or feast, as actually it was back then. We're going to be covering and trying to separate out more of the reality versus the myth, the fact from fiction, when it comes to Thanksgiving, America's big November feast and holiday. Hello, I'm Matt Cale, and on behalf of Expert Village, I'm here.
I thought I was putting on part two, and it sounds like that's the same one. Let me see if we can give you what it's necessary to...
Hello.
Have to find the right... oh, dear. Well, let's try this.
This is a history of the first Thanksgiving. Fall, 1621. In the barren land of North America, the Native Americans run amok with power over their land. A group of pilgrims thrown out of England due to their religious beliefs has just withstood a lengthy trip to North America. Many have died on the way to their new home, and many more will soon die as well. The Battle of Plymouth Rock was a horrific one. On the beaches of Massachusetts, the savage Indians attacked the recently landed pilgrims. The pilgrims, unequipped for such a battle, use fast arm movements and quick comedic slaps to the face to defeat the attacking Indians. Unfortunately, a few pilgrims died in this battle due to arrows and tomahawks hitting them in the face, but ultimately, the pilgrims came away with the victory on this day. Now, the Indians went into hiding due to humiliation and confusion, and the pilgrims were now left to survive a harsh winter, during which many more pilgrims died. But, in the following spring, after fending off the Indians once more, hope was discovered in the form of an Indian. One of the Indian survivors of the spring battle, Squanto, was tortured to his breaking point. The pilgrims taught him English, and after they were able to understand him, he taught the pilgrims how to tend to the earth so they can grow crops in their new environment, as well as sharing with them some of the Indians' customs and traditions, all at musket point. Afterwards, he was shot in the face, and the five remaining pilgrim women made him into stew. Then, the Americans sought out the Indians and offered the Squanto stew as a sign of peace. The unknowing Indians accepted the gift and went back to their camps and then proceeded to eat one of their most
Decorated Indian chiefs, it looks like.
Decorated Indian war chiefs. One pilgrim, who had been spying on the Indians, saw them eat the stew and hurried back to the pilgrim settlement where he delivered the words to his people, "I can't believe it! The Indians just finished eating Squanto!" The pilgrims then shared a laugh. While the pilgrims were laughing at the Indians, one of the eaters got a really bad case of mud butt. This, of course, was unusual to the Indians because they were a healthy people and rarely got diarrhea or forms of it. During this young Indian's case of mud butt, a piece of Squanto's skull came out of him, and the treachery of the pilgrims was revealed. All of the Indians threw up out of disgust and then rode to battle. They attacked the pilgrim camps once again, killing many. During the battle, one of the pilgrims said to the Indian chief, "Almighty chief, please, our children grow weary of the loss of their parents, as do we the loss of our brothers and sisters and husbands and wives. Spare us, and share with us a feast, the feast we were preparing for tonight. Share it with us and call it a feast of peace and thanks, thanking God for all that we have. We will call it Thanksgiving, and forevermore we can share this land rather than fight over it." The Indian chief, not knowing a word of English, threw a tomahawk at the man, which proceeded to hit him in the face and kill him. After the pilgrims fled the camp in fright, the victorious Indians ate all of their food while praying to their God for thanks, and that was the first Thanksgiving.
And, of course, these are the dangers of Internet roulette. Actually, according to Wikipedia, Tisquantum, better known as Squanto, 1580 to 1622, was a Palookset, according to Wikipedia. He was the first Native American who assisted the pilgrims after their first winter in the New World and was integral to their survival. The Patuxet tribe was a tributary to the Wampanoag Confederacy. On his way back to Patuxet in 1614, Tisquantum, Squanto, was captured by Englishman Thomas Hunt. Hunt was one of John Smith's lieutenants. Hunt was planning to sell fish, corn, and captured natives in Malaga, Spain. There, Hunt attempted to sell to Squanto, and a number of other Native Americans into slavery in Spain for £20 apiece. Some local friars discovered what Hunt was attempting and took the remaining Native Americans, Tisquantum included, in order to instruct them in the Christian faith. Tisquantum, Squanto, convinced the friars to let him try to return home. He managed to get to London, where he lived with and worked for a few years with John Slaney, a shipbuilder who apparently taught Tisquantum more English. Slaney took Tisquantum with him when he sailed to Cooper's Cove, Newfoundland. To get to New England, Tisquantum had tried to take part in an expedition to that part of North American East Coast. When that plan fell through, he returned to New England in 1619. At last, in 1619, Tisquantum returned to his homeland, having joined an exploratory expedition along the New England coast. He soon discovered that the Patuxet, as well as a majority of coastal New England tribes, mostly the Wampanoag and Massachusetts, had been decimated the year before by an epidemic plague, possibly smallpox. It had recently been postulated as being due to leptospirosis. Native Americans had no natural immunity to European infectious diseases. Tisquantum finally settled with pilgrims at the site of his former village, which the English named Plymouth. He helped them to recover from an extremely hard first winter by teaching them techniques to increase food production by fertilizing crops. He also showed them the best places to catch fish and eels. He was critical to their survival. In 1621, Tisquantum was the guide and translator for settlers Stephen Hopkins and Edward Winslow as they traveled upland on a diplomatic mission to the Wampanoag Sachem, or Sachem, known today as Massasoit. In a subsequent mission for Governor William Bradford that summer, Tisquantum was captured by the Wampanoag while gathering intelligence on the renegade Sagamore Corbitant at the village of Nemescat, site of the present-day Middleborough, Massachusetts. Miles Standish led a 10-man team of settlers from Plymouth to rescue Tisquantum, Squanto, if he were alive or if he had been killed to avenge him. Tisquantum was found alive and well. He was welcomed back by the pilgrims at Plymouth, where he continued in his vital role as assistant to the colony. Although he worked at alliances, Tisquantum ended up distrusted by both the English and the Wampanoag Massasoit, the Sachem who at first appointed Tisquantum as liaison to the pilgrims. They did not trust him in the tribe's dealings with the settlers. He assigned Hobernock, whose name may have been a pseudonym as it means mischievous, to watch over Squanto, Tisquantum, and act as a second representative. On his way back from a meeting to repair damaged relations between the Wampanoag and pilgrims, Squanto became sick with a fever. Some historians have speculated he was poisoned by the Wampanoag because they believed he had been disloyal to the Sachem. Tisquantum died a few days later in 1622 in Chatham, Massachusetts. He was buried in an unmarked grave, possibly in Plymouth Cemetery, Burial Hill. Peace between the two groups lasted for another 50 years. And that sounds like a more likely account of what went down there. I always call Thanksgiving Turkey Slaughter Day because, I don't know, I have a natural skepticism to commercial holidays, although it's always nice to see families get together, and that's certainly a good thing. Let's get on with some more street interviews and see what's cooking there.
We're here on the streets about 2 o'clock talking with
Julie Costanza.
And Julie, you're it's actually around 2:30, and you're a, well, it's Sunday the 21st of November, and you're involved with the in-home care workers?
I am.
What is your position?
Support. I'm a care provider for elders and disabled people, and we're still, we have this long fight with the county of Santa Cruz. They want to lower our pay by $3 an hour, and they want us down like to minimum wage. And one of the good things with the city council that I can say is going on is they are in full support of us, mm-hmm. and they just did a 10-year anniversary for the living wage, and they'd like to extend it to us. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of city against county now, and we're hoping the county people wake up and decide to help providers like myself, because otherwise we'll probably have to strike. That's the first time we've ever really talked about that, and I'd like to see them take care of 1,400 disabled people overnight.
That's how many in-home care workers there are in the county?
That's how many caregivers there are. There's 1,800 being served by 1,400 people.
And how many people do you serve personally?
I serve at present 2 people.
And I know that you used to be in the real estate business.
Yeah, I used to be. I used to have some apartments down at the beach flats.
How did you change your approach and mend your ways?
Well,
the city bounced out the apartments.
So. Yeah, they did, and I don't think they're doing it because they like me. I think they're doing it because it's the right thing to do right now. Back then, they were trying to knock down the apartments and put in new ones.
Dolphin Lee.
The Dolphin Lee apartments, and my parents owned the Lee apartments. So,
what was the ultimate outcome of that? How is that? How is the project? What's it called? Nueva Vista now?
Because we did what we did, we stopped the project for 18 months because with my help and help of other people from Residentes Unidos, including Robert and Becky, we had a lot of support.
That's Robert Norris, the very famous and much beloved questioner.
because of all the help we had and the press that we got and Trader Joe's bringing food to us every other Tuesday downtown because we had...
She doesn't mean Trader Joe's. She means Joe Schultz, India Joe's. Trader Joe's wasn't in town in 2001 when the city council tried to ram through a demolition of the Dolphin and Lee apartments with no guarantees that those who were in them would be able to come back to the new project sponsored by Mercy Charities Housing. This is an issue that some of us in Huff had a long struggle to demand guarantees for those who are currently housed to be able to come back, and that the liberals on the city council, notably Mayor Tim Fitzmaurice, did not want to provide. I don't know how accurate that Julie Costanza, then known as Costanza Gomez, who we're talking to here, is now an in-home care worker activist, is in saying that everybody got back in, but because I did some small follow-ups on the building of the large Nueva Vista, also known as the Dolphin Lee Project, and after the demolition of the other apartments, huge amount of money was spent, and the money could have been spent on purchasing new land and building additional stuff instead of destroying existing housing. That was our main point. And that, however, was ignored, ridiculed, mocked, and sidelined by the city council, which was, again, the liberalist city council that has ever been, in the last 25 years, in my experience, in power in Santa Cruz. So sometimes it's the liberals who aren't interested in people's rights as well. In fact, often that can be the case if you want to look at the current. Well, you don't really have liberals in power nationally, but you know, liberals supporting an imperialist war criminal abroad, President Obama, who's expanding the war in Afghanistan, extending the date of departure to 2014, increasing military expenditures, maintaining huge forces in Iraq, modernizing the nuclear force, and all the kind of crap that you would have associated with those evil Republicans, you know.
Full families out there, and we had a lot of support, and they were pressured, and they finally gave the guarantees that the people who lived in those apartments got to come back, and I have to say most of them are still there, and I'm really happy about that.
Did they actually get all the guarantees? Because I thought there was some gaps.
Who ended that around for?
To my knowledge, everyone got to come back, and the ones that didn't got some money, so they could move on.
Enough money to actually pay, or just a...
It was like $5,000 to just go away.
Get out of here. Here's your 5G.
Yeah.
And we actually did some analysis at the time to determine if that would actually pay for the lodging for a year or two, which is what was happening as they were destroying people's housing. And it didn't really cover the cost of housing for that period of time. I think that was our conclusion. Again, I don't have the solid figures here.
Something like that.
So... The city, of course, the city council has never paid a living wage to, or has never asked for even a minimum wage raise in the city in terms of workers. In fact, they refused to put that on their agenda a couple years ago. But they do pay living wage to city employees, I suppose.
That's my understanding. And what we're trying to do, we won't get their living wage. It'll be our living wage. They feel like we can live off $11 an hour.
Yeah, you
we're
can live off less.
That.
You're shorter.
Yeah. But I think their living wage for the higher class people, I guess that's what it is, they get 15 something an hour.
Yeah, well,
and
they
benefits,
deserve more.
And they get overtime, which we don't get
well,
overtime.
You don't need overtime.
Yeah, we don't get our dental plan is just one that it's just a word. It doesn't do anything.
Don't lose your teeth is a dental plan.
Yeah, exactly.
Don't get cavities. Very simple.
We don't get sick pay.
I just don't get sick. That's all.
Although we're around a lot of sick people all the time.
Oh, it's the coincidence,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. We don't have
you
backup.
Be more careful about
if
that.
You can't come to work, you just have to come anyway because there's no one to back you up.
So it'll make a better person of you there.
It's definitely not a luxurious job, but if we weren't attached to... What's happening with us is instead of it being a job, it's our responsibility. And in reality, it's the responsibility of the government to take care of these people, and the way they need to do that is by paying us properly.
We've been talking with
Julie Costanza.
And is there any number people can call if they want to get more information or website they can go to?
Well, you can call me at 650-518-4458, or you can call the SEIU union, who is trying really hard to help us keep the money that we're getting, the lower living wage.
Lower because of you're a lower class person.
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah. Nothing personal. Just
yeah, I don't
you grew a few inches.
I don't take it personally
no,
at all.
Certainly not.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
In line at the Civic Auditorium. It's around noon on Thanksgiving Day, November 25th. Actually, it's about 12:15. And I'm at the end of the line, which kind of stretches around the block. I'm talking with
Billy.
And Billy, you had something you wanted to say.
I think that they should leave sleeping dogs sleep. That's all I say.
And sleeping people, too?
And people, too.
Have you had problems with that, like with police or security guards? Or?
That's all I had to say.
Oh, thank you, man.
But then I go shopping and buy myself things, and then I don't feel so bad.
La, 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 la. Very nice. Joe Schultz gave us the, what was the first line?
Homeless people, unemployment tends to make me sad. But then I go shopping and buy myself things, and then I don't feel so bad.
Yeah, we should have actually done a little round of downtown there. That's Joe Schultz and me at the Civic Auditorium earlier today. in front of the Civic Auditorium, actually. And here's some more interviews.
Yeah, we got to think of more lyrics for that. Thank you, Joe. Any comments on this? Thanksgiving. Yes.
Great,
well, probably.
That's great. I love. May all be fed. May all be fed. That's great. Yeah.
And we have this person signing a petition. Your name?
Eden Bresnahan.
And Eden, what? I don't want to ask what brings you here. Obviously, I imagine the food brings you here, not the company particularly. I mean, who wants to talk to a bathrobe?
Well, actually, what brings me here is the hassle for sitting, sleeping, smoking, etc. I would like to actually speak up at a free radio Santa Cruz station at 427-3772.
This will be on the radio tonight.
Persecute real crime, not homeless people doing what they need to do to survive. So I would like to call the DA, Bob, but demand all charges against peace camps to be dropped, you know, and if you'd like to speak up about that, you can call 454-2400.
I didn't pay you to read that, did I?
No.
Do I get a hug?
Yes, you do.
All right. I'll come over here. So I'm talking to Colette Connolly, who is one of the most notorious Peace Camp 2010 defendants, a known sleep criminal and lodger who is facing criminal charges, prosecution by Bob Lee, the district attorney. But yesterday she went to court, and she's kind of resting here on the curbside. I don't want to, you know, grill her again, but I hear from what you're telling me, correct me if I'm wrong, Colette, that this was a setting hearing, and it's there won't be anything really happening until February with the cases. Is that right?
There are like six dates set, two of which I don't have to show up for, four of which I do. And the last one, I believe, is the trial. It's like late in January, early in February. You know, these dates are all subject to change, depending. Yeah.
So how many defendants were in court in your group?
Again, for those who don't know, Peace Camp 2010 was a three-month-long vigilant protest in front of first the county building, then City Hall, to demand that homeless people be allowed to sleep not anywhere and everywhere, but somewhere, without being faced with the threat of arrest or ticketing or fining or slave labor, sometimes called community service. Many people have received not just sleeping ban tickets, which are infractions that can often be dealt with by going to the homeless service center and getting a letter, though that process may have become more complicated. I did ask Monica Martinez about that issue. She's the head of the homeless service center, who showed up to make a rousing speech at the Thanksgiving meal today. But when asked, what's the story with the current law that says if you're on a waiting list, then we'll write off your ticket, and, you know, how do we get on the waiting list, and, you know, do you get any proof you're on the waiting list? You can show it to the police officer, say, sir, please don't ticket me, I'm on the waiting list. She said that she wouldn't talk about it because now is not the time or the place, and so I couldn't get any information on that. But Peace Camp 2010 was and is, people are still concerned who are part of that movement, to, of course, changing the laws that make homeless people criminals at night for sleeping. Innocent behavior. It's not only a city ordinance, but the city police and the county sheriffs use an ancient state law, 647E, which is a sort of a it's called an anti-loitering statute, and it's used to bust up protests often at public buildings, claiming that people are lodging, and in fact they're simply exercising their First Amendment rights, First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution and the California Constitution, which guarantees freedom of speech of the press, the right of the people peaceably to assemble and protest for and seek a redress of grievances, not to mention freedom of religion and freedom of to be free from religion as well, which is not exactly the way the First Amendment puts it, but that's kind of the gist of it. Anyway, Colette is a 73-year-old woman who has gotten multiple citations because she's insisted on continuing to be a visible presence every night, or was throughout July, August, and September at Peace Camp 2010. And if, for those interested in the saga of Peace Camp, there really is a lot of information. I was kind of bemoaning the fact that there's been no news stories posted really in the last month. I'm to blame for as much as anyone. But there's a lot of older stories that really tell the story of Peace Camp, and there's some video, and there's some audio, I believe, a lot of pictures on the Peace Camp 2010 website. Go to peacecamp2010.blogspot.com and check it out if you're interested. And by the way, in case you just tuned in, this is Free Radio, 101.1 FM, www.freakradio.org. This is November 25th, Thanksgiving evening. I don't think the Indians are getting much thanks, and there's not much giving going on there. But, hey, everybody else gets to buy turkey and embrace their loved ones. Isn't that exciting? Actually, I mean, it's always nice to do that, whether it's today or any other day. But it's always seemed to me to be a kind of a bunch of hokum, frankly. That's how I see it. But, you know, any excuse for a party, and, hey, if they're going to feed homeless people on Thanksgiving, I say right on, even right on to Steve Plaich. Keep up the good work, Steve. He was one of the people behind, in fact, he was the initiator of the restarted the Thanksgiving meal this year, and, which was much smaller, as I mentioned before, than past years, maybe because it just didn't get the publicity, or, I don't know, maybe because people just too well fed to show up. No, that couldn't be it. Anyway, here's more from that street interview.
Including our lawyer who...
And again, this is Colette Connolly of Peace Camp 2010 talking about a court appearance she had yesterday, actually, in which she, Ed Fry, Gary Johnson, and several others who are going to be tried for... They face 6 months in jail and a $1,000 fine, potentially, for the crime, essentially, of peacefully protesting at night, which this county is calling lodging for being on the steps of the county building, which is the seat of government in the county. You know, where else would you be if you were going to protest? You would think the seat of government, right? Don't try that in Santa Cruz, you know. At least don't try it for a month, which is what they did. In a city which has shelter for less than 5%, or maybe if they had the armory, 7 to 10% of the homeless people, and the rest face citations if at the whim of the police or the whim of a cranky neighbor or somebody doesn't want them around in the area. It's illegal to be homeless at night if you need to sleep in Santa Cruz.
He's also defending himself.
Ed Fry.
Yeah, Ed Fry. Six of us, including him. I call us the Santa Cruz Six.
Santa Cruz Six. Yeah. Actually, there are more than that. There were dozens given these citations.
The Santa Cruz Sleep-In Six. Well, those of us who are there in this particular, others have chosen other routes. Say Gary Johnson is defending himself, and ably, I might say. And actually, he was one of the ones that was gathered in under the umbrella of Ed Fry. So he was one there. There's nothing conclusive that's going to come about until next year.
Yeah, that's what I was hearing. I've heard some cases aren't being charged, like Robert Facer, who was in line here earlier. He got a ticket for a misdemeanor charge for lodging, but that hasn't appeared in court, even though it was a 647E. So it's interesting. They're picking and choosing who they want to charge.
Well, that could be. I hadn't kept up with it. Robert and I don't cross paths very often, so I don't talk to him. He's a very quiet man anyway.
Yeah, he left his backpack outside, as apparently people are being directed to do. I don't know whether it's security or bureaucracy or paranoia.
Lack of space. There just isn't enough room for all the backpacks.
And that wasn't really true. I looked inside, and there was plenty of room. Usually the Civic Auditorium, for example, when the Grey Bears have their meal, is really filled with tables. On this occasion, there was, I would say, at least a quarter to a third of the Civic was untabled, and backpacks could have been taken in. So I found myself wondering, and at least a moment ago, when I remembered that conversation I had with Colette, people, all these homeless folks were being asked to risk their possessions to go in and get a Thanksgiving meal under the pretext that there's not enough space. I don't know, maybe they should get a pat-down or a grope-down like other folks are getting who are trying to travel back to their families. Compliments of the Transportation Security Agency, is that what it's called?
Okay. Oh,
They caught it at the door.
And we have Crow's reindeer dog here, a tiny puppy, who she actually was going to be the subject of a poster, which Crow was not able to make, showing Mia Duquette, a city worker, blow-drying the puppy's hair in a sort of a, well, not as a hairdresser, but more as a get-the-fuck-out-of-here sort of thing, or else I'll blow you away.
After that.
What's that?
Somebody got that on camera.
Right, and I think the Crow was trying to get a photo, but we weren't able to get the, he wasn't able to get it blown up to the appropriate size for this protest. We hoped it would be, but maybe next week.
Next time.
Well, this is support for the criminals like yourself who have been convicted or not convicted. Or,
I see. That's definitely a criminal right there.
Yeah, you can tell this woman has a criminal hat. I mean, what kind of, look at that. Yeah, there's a criminal. Look at that hat. I mean, my God. She sleeps outside at night. Now, that can be, that's really criminal behavior in Santa Cruz. And here's a criminal puppy with a bizarre set of horns. That's another story. Now, that's his dog.
And there's the other criminal over here.
There are criminals everywhere if you don't watch your step. Are you still outside?
No, I'm sleeping at the armory.
Very good. How is the armory?
Oh, it's going very well this year. It's a naval hand. I'm getting two mats. I'm being treated, to quote the armory manager, like a queen.
And how full is the armory generally with all this rainy weather?
Getting there. We're reached up to 75. That's three quarters of our capacity. We can have 100 people in on the floor there.
Interesting. I know Doug Loisel, the former homeless service center director, said there was only capacity for 75, even though they squeeze more people in. But apparently they're...
significance of that, claiming that the capacity is 100 rather than 75, means A, if you want to, you can always claim there's more room and people don't need to have their tickets dismissed. This can't be argued so easily now because the law has slightly changed. But in past years, the rule has been unless the armory is full, tickets that are given outside for sleeping will not be dismissed because people, in theory, could have gone to the armory if they'd known there was space, if they'd been able to pass through the ID checks, if they'd not had to carry all their stuff with them, if they didn't have a pet, if they weren't doing any drinking or drugs, seemed to be under the influence, if they weren't in a couple and didn't want to sleep together. All the things that ordinary adults normally try to do, if they're willing to surrender all those things and also risk perhaps some health problems of having 100 people or 75 to 100 people in the same room, they could do that. And, you know, Colette has told us that it's pretty good. She's enjoying it. She's choosing to go there where in the past she has chosen to sleep outside. So that says something. Let's not, over-demonize the armory, not at all. But the significance of the claim now that, the armory has a capacity of 100 rather than 75, is to me, sounds suspiciously like a way of saying, see, we have more space when actually there's no, I'm not aware there's any more space this year than there was in past years. And 75 means that's how many the armory comfortably lodges, not 100, 75. But 100 is what you want to do if, you have other motivations, maybe political motivations. Again, I'm not happy with Monica Martinez, the head of the Homeless Service Center, who doesn't seem to be too candid or forthcoming in answers to important questions, as I've mentioned before on this show and earlier in this program, about the rights of homeless people in terms of and the policies of the Homeless Service Center. So I have a certain bias here. I'd like to know more information. Maybe they have expanded the armory. They've opened up, who knows, maybe they threw out some of the rifle retentions in the back and allowed extra cots to be put in. But I haven't heard anything either way on that.
Changing their figures now.
No, it's always been 100 as far as I know.
No, that's not what he told me a year ago, but I guess different perspectives on it. Any other thoughts for our audience?
Oh, I wish you a Merry Christmas. I wish you a Merry Christmas. I wish you a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year.
And don't sleep around here. So you say the Homeless Service Center lot is closed today at Thanksgiving?
Yes, you can't even get in to pee.
Oh, now they've closed the restroom. At Loisel, I think, didn't do that.
For today.
Just for today.
I don't know about tomorrow.
Maybe they figure people should fertilize the fields today. What do you think?
Well, I'll tell you something. That will be happening, and this won't continue, in my opinion. Local businesses there do not like the fact that their doorways get to be used for temporary privies. And, you know, what else are you going to do?
And Ed Fry's porta potty, which was every night at the city hall and or at the county building for the homeless protest, is not there anymore.
No. Everybody used it. In fact, we had people in the neighborhood dropping in because they liked ours better than their bathroom, I guess. There was a guy who came, he'd drive up in his vehicle, hop out, use our porta potty, get back in his vehicle, and leave for work every morning over here at City Hall. We could, you know, comment.
You could made him pay to pee, that's what.
We thought about it. There was rumors that Kubica was doing it, charging a buck for those tourists that turned up that whole slew of them the day that we had the marathon. They were saying, well, we pay taxes too.
And what Colette is talking about is the porta potty that was rented, compliments of philanthropist Paul Lee and activist Ed Fry, and brought to the protest. This is the first time we actually have ever had a paid porta potty at a homeless protest over a fairly long period of time. And it was generally reserved for the use of homeless people at the protest, although if other people wanted to use it, you know, with permission, they could. And Kubica was a relatively eccentric, somewhat unpredictable, occasionally violent, and definitely messy protester who had his own ideas about what to do and his own approach to life. I've actually interviewed him a number of times for this program, but he kind of tried my patience when he was caught stealing other people's stuff and then threatening other people physically and so forth. So that became a problem, and he got on my blacklist. So you're on my blacklist, Kubica. But I actually saw him again a couple weeks ago, and he was mellow. But I don't know. I guess a person's past, to some extent, follows them around, and it's a problem. But Thanksgiving, a time of forgiveness, right, if you're a Christian, or maybe even if you're not.
No, we pay for this body. You can't use it. Wait, they were mad. Now, that was a screw-up. The people who masterminded the marathon should have provided porta-potties for those people and didn't. That was last summer. I don't remember.
Well, the audience gets to hear it. I'm having a little trouble. I don't know if my hearing is going bad or it's just we have a lot of ambient noise here. But we've been talking with
Colette Conley. We haven't been heard yet. Our day in court is still coming.
Or and not. Once it comes, you still won't be heard in court, even if they hear you. They aren't going to listen, I'm afraid. But who knows?
No, they will hear us.
I hope so.
If there are enough of us, they have to. We'll keep coming back, what we can say.
Right on. Thank you, Colette.
Love.
And to you. All right, wait, we got a congratulations here. What's your name? Come on.
Steven.
Steven, what's this congratulations? Go ahead, tell me.
To you for what you did for us.
What have I done
for you?
I just
heard about it. I'm new.
Oh.
You got parks or something. I don't know.
No. I mean, we're trying to change the law. We haven't really been terribly successful. We keep working at it, though. That's what we're doing. Yeah, I mean, in all honesty,
I've been homeless 20 years. I good luck, brother. They hate it. They hate you when you're sleeping. See, because when they come to work, they want to be sleeping too, and they see you laying down in your. You know, I've had them honk their horn. We react, lay on their freaking horn because I'm laying on the ground sleeping in their business.
We don't want your kind around here.
But no, they want to still be in beds because I'm in Frisco's the same thing. We sleep where they park their cars, and they hate their job. And they have to be up. So they see us sleeping there, and he just infuriates them. They pisses them off. That's what I feel. And those are the ones that we're against.
How long have you been in Santa Cruz?
Us. Oh, I come here off and on 5 years.
And have you seen any changes in the last 5 years?
Oh, I'm stoned. I stay by the levee. I don't venture very far.
So you haven't noticed much that you want to comment on? Less harassment, more harassment, same level.
Oh, they don't bother me too. I don't drink. They don't bother me too bad. I just smoke bud, good bud. No bad bud.
And no hassles for smoking bud?
No, not really. No.
Well, that's good.
That's why I quit drinking, though.
And has your health improved?
From what?
From not drinking.
Nah, I just tired of blacking out.
That makes sense. We've been talking with?
Steve.
Thanks, Steve.
Thank you.
Talking with
guys, I just want a bottle of vodka.
12. Check it out and good luck. And when was the last time you had a bottle of vodka?
It's been a while.
So you're hoping maybe inside a little vodka?
Maybe it's a Thanksgiving spirit here. Yeah.
Maybe somebody will slip you a bottle of vodka. Any comments for Free Radio?
Yeah. To hell with them. I said, bomb Iran, North Korea. Let's get it on.
City Hall?
I didn't say that.
That's a couple of police officers. We have to take you into custody now. Mm. So, would you like to give your name and social security number?
My social security number?
Well, no, anything. We've been talking.
I'm going to report you to the NCICA.
How about the TSA? Then they can pat me down. That would be exciting, man. Anyway, thank you.
And let's take a TSA break. Folks may be aware that the, it's Transportation Security Administration has now adopted a new policy of requiring you to go through this invasive scan, which is not only a violation of your privacy because it shows all your most precious innermost parts, usually reserved for intimate contact, but it also subjects everybody, one person or another, whatever your state of health or age or illness or whatever, to scanning machines that there's been some question about their safety. Or you can go for a grope-a-thon with some TSA people. And here's an article I ran across called TSA's Gestapo Empire, A Greater Threat Than the Terrorists, on Counterpunch website from yesterday, by Paul Craig Roberts, who interestingly enough, has gotten more radical since he was in the Reagan administration. He was an assistant secretary of the Treasury way back when, in the 80s. But here's what he writes. It doesn't take a bureaucrat long to create an empire. John Pistole, the FBI agent who took over the Transportation Security Administration on July 1st, told USA Today 16 days later that protecting trains and subways from terrorist attacks will be as high a priority for him as air travel. It is difficult to imagine New Yorkers being porno-screened and sexually groped on crowded subway platforms or showing up an hour or two in advance for clearance for a 15-minute subway ride. But once bureaucrats get the bit in their teeth, they take absurdity to its logical conclusion. Buses will be next, although it's even more difficult to imagine open-air bus stops turned into security zones with screeners and gropers inspecting passengers before they board. Will taxi passengers be next? In those Muslim lands whose citizens the U.S. government has been slaughtering for years, favorite weapons for retaliating against the Americans are car and truck bombs. How long before Pistole announces that the TSA Gestapo is setting up roadblocks on city streets, highways, and interstates to check cars for bombs? The 15-minute trip to the grocery store then becomes an all-day affair. Indeed, it has already begun. Last September, agents from Homeland Security, TSA, and the U.S. Department of Transportation, assisted by the Douglas County Sheriff's Office, conducted a counterterrorism operation on busy Interstate 20 just west of Atlanta, Georgia. Designated Viper, Visible Intermobile Prevention and Response, the operation required all trucks to stop to be screened for bombs. Federal agents used dogs, screening devices, and a large drive-through bomb detection machine. Imagine what the delays did to delivery schedules and truckers' bottom lines. There were also news reports of federal trucks equipped with backscanner X-ray devices that secretly scan cars and pedestrians. With such expensive counterterrorism activities, both in terms of the hard-pressed taxpayers' money and civil liberties, one would think that the bombs were going off all over America, but of course they aren't. There has not been a successful terrorist act since 9/11, and many doubt the government's explanation of that event. Subsequent domestic terrorist events have turned out to be FBI sting operations in which FBI agents organize not-so-bright, disaffected members of society and lead them into displaying interest in participating in a terrorist act. Once the FBI agent, pretending to be a terrorist, succeeds in prompting all the right words to be said and captured on his hidden recorder, the, quote, terrorists are arrested and the, quote, plot exposed. The very fact that the FBI has to orchestrate fake terrorism proves the absence of real terrorists. If Americans were more thoughtful and less gullible, they might wonder why all the emphasis on transportation when there are so many soft targets. Shopping centers, for example. If there were enough terrorists in America to justify the existence of Homeland Security, bombs would be going off round the clock in shopping malls in every state. The effect would be far more terrifying than blowing up an airliner. And I thought about this afterward, and I realized that airliners, of course, isn't only the issue of blowing up an airliner. It's the issue of moving an airliner to crash into a strategic building, like the Pentagon, for example. Dare I say that they needed better aim? Indeed, if terrorists want to attack air travelers, they never need to board an airplane. All they need to do is join the throngs of passengers waiting to go through the TSA scanners and set off their bombs. The TSA has conveniently assembled the targets. The final proof that there are no terrorists is that not a single neoconservative or government official responsible for the Bush regime's invasions of Iraq and Afghanistan and the Obama regime's slaughters of Pakistanis, Yemenis, and Somalians has been assassinated. None of these Americans who are responsible for lies, deceptions, and invasions that have destroyed the lives of countless numbers of Muslims have any security protection. If Muslims were capable of pulling off 9/11, they are certainly capable of assassinating Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz, Pearl, Fife, Libby, Condi Rice, Crystal, Bolton, Goldberg, and scores of others during the same hour on the same day. I am not advocating the terrorists assassinate anyone. I am just making the point that if the U.S. was as overrun with terrorists as empire-building bureaucrats pretend, we would definitely be experiencing dramatic terrorist acts. The argument is not believable that a government that was incapable of preventing 9/11 is so all-knowing that it can prevent assassinations of unprotected neocons and shopping malls from being bombed. If Al-Qaeda was anything like the organization that the U.S. government claims, it would not be focused on trivial targets such as passenger planes. The organization would be focused on its real enemies. Try to imagine the propaganda value of terrorists wiping out the neoconservatives in one fell swoop, followed by an announcement that every member of the federal government down to the lowest GS, every member of the House and Senate, and every governor was next in line to be bumped off. Think about it. This would be real terrorism instead of the makes-believe stuff associated with shoe bombs that don't work, underwear bombs that independent experts say could not work, and bottled water and shampoo bombs that experts say cannot possibly be put together in airliner laboratories. Would a terrorist organization capable of outwitting all 16 U.S. intelligence agencies, all intelligence agencies of U.S. allies, including Israel's Mossad, the National Security Council, NORAD, Air Traffic Control, the Pentagon, and Air Security four times in 1 hour, put its unrivaled prestige at risk with improbable shoe bombs, shampoo bombs, and underwear bombs? After success in destroying the World Trade Center and blowing up part of the Pentagon, it is an extraordinary come-down to go after a mere airliner. Would a person who gains fame by knocking out the world heavyweight boxing champion make himself a laughingstock by taking lunch money from schoolboys? TSA is a far greater threat to Americans than our terrorists. That's the Transportation Security Administration that's implementing all these pat-downs and X-ray scans. Pistole, who's the head of TSA, has given the finger to U.S. senators and representatives, state legislators, and the traveling public who have expressed their views that virtual strip searches and sexual molestation are too high a price to pay for security. Indeed, the TSA, with its Gestapo attitude and methods, is succeeding in making Americans more terrified of the TSA than they are of terrorists. Make up your own mind. What terrifies you the most? Terrorists, who are in all likelihood you will never encounter in your lifetime, or the TSA that you will encounter every time you fly, and soon, according to Pistole, every time you take a train, a subway, or drive in a car or truck. Before making up your mind, consider this report from antiwar.com on November 19th. Quote, TSA officials say that anyone refusing both the full body scans and the enhanced pat-down procedures will be taken into custody. Once there, the detainees will not only be barred from flying, but will be held indefinitely as terrorist suspects. One sheriff's office said they were already preparing to handle a large number of detainees and plan to treat them as terrorist suspects. Not sure where that report comes from, but it doesn't sound very good. Who is cowing Americans into submission? Terrorists or the TSA Gestapo? And that's by Paul Craig Roberts. The article is TSA's Gestapo Empire, A Greater Threat Than the Terrorists, by Paul Craig Roberts, a November 24th story on the Counterpunch website. Here's one by James Ridgway, Invasion of the Body Scanners. On the eve of some of the busiest travel days of the year, airport scanners are causing hysteria, and with good reason. Never mind the puerile TSA screeners giggling at your naked body. It turns out that the things may pose serious health concerns. In a letter to John Pistole, administrator of TSA, New Jersey Congressman Rush Holt, a scientist and the chair of the House Select Intelligence Oversight Panel, raised the possibility that the machines might be carcinogenic. Quote, in March, the Congressional Biomedical Caucus, of which I am a co-chair, hosted a presentation of this technology by TSA, as well as a briefing by Dr. David Brenner of Columbia University on the potential health effects of back scanner X-ray devices. As Dr. Brenner noted in his presentation and in subsequent media interviews, the devices currently in use and proposed for wider deployment this year currently deliver to the scalp 20 times the average dose that is typically quoted by TSA and throughout the industry. Dr. Brenner has pointed out that the majority of the radiation from X-ray back scanner machines strikes the top of the head, which is where 85% of the 800,000 cases of basal cell carcinoma diagnosed in the U.S. each year develop. That's cancer, folks. According to Dr. Brenner, excessive X-ray exposure can cause a cancer rate multiplier, which is why our government should investigate thoroughly the potential health risks associated with this technology. And again, that's Congressman Rush Holt. The writer continues, and the writer is James Ridgway in his article Invasion of the Body Scanners, again on Counterpunch. Various experts have questioned whether older people and children ought to be subjected to scanners and whether people susceptible to or having melanoma and cataracts should go through the scan. Holt also questioned the efficacy of the body scanners, which would come as no surprise to critics who've been lambasting them for years. Last January, when the government's appetite for body scanners got a big boost from the underwear bomber, there was skepticism about their ability to detect the types of explosives favored by would-be airline bombers. As I wrote at the time, quote, known by their opponents as digital strip search machines, the full-body scanners use one of two technologies, millimeter wave sensors or backscatter X-rays, to see through clothing, producing ghostly images of naked passengers. Yet critics say that these two are highly fallible and are incapable of revealing explosives hidden in body cavities, an age-old method for smuggling contraband. If that's the case, a terrorist could hide the entire bomb works within his or her body and breeze through the virtual strip search undetected. Yesterday, the London Independent reported on authoritative claims that officials at the UK Department of Transport and the Home Office have already tested the scanners and were not persuaded they would work comprehensively against terrorist threats to aviation. A British defense research firm reportedly found the machines unreliable in detecting low-density materials like plastics, chemicals, and liquids, precisely what the underwear bomber had stuffed in his briefs. Just to be sure I'm not going off the deep end on this subject, I emailed Steve Elson, the intrepid former Navy SEAL who worked on the federal government's Red Team, which was deployed in the years before 9/11 to test airport security by infiltrating through checkpoints. This they did with ease, but no one ever paid any attention to their reports. Since 9/11, Elson has worked on and off with television crews, continuing to penetrate airport security, carrying with him all manner of guns and IEDs, improvised explosive devices, and for the most part avoiding detection. In a CBC program last year at this time, the Canadians reviewed the air security situation and found it to be wanting. The reporters also got a hold of a redacted report from the Canadian Transport People, which raised questions about the effectiveness of full-body scanners, especially when they are used in combination with metal detectors. A person passing through one machine after another would have to place their arms in different positions, and the Canadians found the body scanners would fail to detect objects like rings or bracelets on extended arms because the mechanism could not reach high enough to take them in. This morning's Washington Post carried a list of people exempt from body scanning, including cops and military in uniform. I asked Elson about this, and he replied, "When I was traveling through Chicago last January on my way to Toronto to do an interview, I had some time between planes, got a sandwich, no place to sit down, so I literally walked into the back of a checkpoint that was enclosed by glass so everyone could see what was going on, sat down on a bench and ate my sandwich and watched. No one touched the pilots. Ergo, all I needed was a pilot's uniform, bought or stolen, and a Photoshop badge. Put explosives on my body, no metal, walk through, pick up my stuff, and off to the plane. Likewise, I could do something similar on the ramp. Best time is in cold weather and snowstorms. Do it as night approaches. People don't care about security, just getting the job done and getting out of the weather. Steal a bag tag, make an unauthorized entry, no problem. Walk up to a plane and throw it in with 50 pounds of explosives." Elson has always contended that the body scanner couldn't detect explosives in body cavities. In his email, he added this: "The machine can see through a thin layer of clothing and probably detect explosives strapped to the body," but he pointed out that Leslie Stahl on 60 Minutes worried about exposing private parts, but noted she could see a woman's bra. If she could see the bra, that means she could not see through the bra. A bra bomb or explosives molded to the breast wouldn't be seen, he continues. And a woman, because of her anatomical construction, could easily bring a several-pound IED fully assembled with timer, detonator, power sources right through the checkpoint. If scanned or patted down, it would make no difference. Once on the plane, she has the option to leave it in the plane and get off. Ellison warns that a well-planned Al-Qaeda operation, if they did it right, could knock down 50 planes in 30 minutes. Think about that, what that would do to U.S. air operations. In my opinion, the best answer to airport security is the mass deployment of dogs. Give me a friendly German Shepherd, and I'll gladly submit to being sniffed or rather than patted, wanded, or scanned. But unlike the scanner companies, dogs have no powerful lobbyists like former Homeland Security Chief Michael Chertoff to advocate on their behalf. And, of course, I don't advocate dogs or anything else. I think this whole thing is a bunch of ridiculous. Frankly, it's like the scanner we have at the county building, which requires everyone to empty their pockets and take off their belts and sometimes take off their shoes. And you have to, if you ask how many actual weapons have ever been found and what the justification for this was, you don't get very credible answers from the guards. But it seems to be done anyway. People are kind of in a trance. They walk through believing it has some sort of security function. And here's another story. False choices in airport security, although I'm wondering why I'm reading this, since most homeless people have trouble getting enough money to go on a bus, much less a plane. But to me, it's an example of eroding civil liberties in this country that has kind of reached the breaking point. If people tolerate this kind of shit, we're really out of luck. False choices in airport security. First, a hand on your crotch, next, a boot in your face, by Michael Scott. If the American public does not stand up and oppose the TSA-enforced false choice between potentially dangerous irradiating body scanners or what amounts to federally mandated sexual harassment, then the republic is almost certainly lost. In the cause of fighting the war on terror, the evisceration of the Bill of Rights will have finally been achieved. Americans must draw the proverbial line in the sand over this issue. The body scans and the invasive pat-downs violate the Fourth Amendment. Despite the statements issued by the PSA, American citizens do not cede their constitutional rights when they buy a plane ticket or enter an airport. John Pistole, director of the TSA, and Janet Napolitano, Secretary of Homeland Security, have been all over the media defending the new TSA pat-downs and body scanners. Both have said that the new procedures are a must for airport security in the wake of the underwear bomber and the recent attempted use of explosive-laced toner bombs. Both attacks were purportedly organized by the Yemeni-based Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. After the underwear bomber's attempt to blow himself up on a Northwest flight from Amsterdam to Detroit, the DHS rushed to deploy body scanners, some of which had already been purchased, at airports across the U.S. One of the primary advocates for the use of body scanners, or the more politically correct advanced imaging technology, AIT, is former DHS head Michael Chertoff. Secretary Chertoff's advocacy of body scanners dates back to at least 2005. After leaving DHS, Chertoff founded the Chertoff Group, a consultancy firm whose corporate logo is an iron-spiked closing portcullis. I'm not quite sure what that is, but I should know, but I don't. The Chertoff Group represents the primary manufacturer of body scanners. Rapiscan, or is it Rapiscan, which is set to make billions of dollars off the sale and manufacture of the body scanners. In the days after the attempted underwear bombing, Chertoff made the rounds on the cable news talk shows where he stressed the necessity of deploying body scanners. Of course, Chertoff failed to disclose the fact that his company represented Rapiscan. Chertoff is not alone in having conflicting interests. A competing manufacturer of body scan systems, American Science and Technology, has retained the services of two former TSA administrators who are now acting as lobbyists. Thanks to the botched bombings and the efforts of Chertoff and lobbyists, the largely untested and potentially dangerous scanners are set to replace the traditional metal detectors at airports across the country. This despite the fact that a number of security experts have said that scanners would not have stopped Umar Farouk, the underwear bomber. The scanner is not able to detect substances or items hidden in human cavities, a tactic Al-Qaeda used in an attempt to assassinate Prince Nayef, the Assadi counterterrorism head. Alternatives like the much less expensive and exclusively tested use of, here we go, bomb-sniffing dogs were not considered, despite the fact that well-trained dogs are far more likely to detect a bomb hidden in a human cavity in addition to being able to detect traces of substance used in explosives on a person's clothes or body. No doubt it is much harder to make a profit off of training dogs, and the dogs would require skillful and well-trained handlers. And there's more here. The article finally concludes, the TSA and the Department of Homeland Security may have done the country a favor by implementing such draconian and unconstitutional practices. They may just make us remember what the U.S. once stood for and what a monumental accomplishment our Bill of Rights is for all of humanity. They might have reminded some of us what is worth fighting for, what it really means to be free. Freedom most certainly does not mean that when you enter an airport that you are a prisoner of the TSA and subject to the whims of often poorly trained agents on a power trip. Freedom does not mean being forced to stand by as your child has a stranger rub his or her hands all over him or her. Freedom does not mean we must submit to dehumanizing searches in the name of safety. Our forefathers and all those men and women deployed around the world in the armed services, and here we go again, did not or are not fighting for the right of a government agency to force Americans in to make a false choice between passing through a radiating naked body scan or being felt up. Unfortunately, that's exactly what the troops are fighting for, unfortunately, because the more they occupy foreign countries and kill foreign citizens, the more likely terrorist incidents become, because people in those countries want the U.S. out and they want to find some way to do that. And sometimes the way that you do that, if you don't have planes and missiles and ships, is you use improvised explosive devices. And these are articles from Counterpunch website. And finally, in conclusion, I have a little ditty called I'll Be Groped for Christmas, which, well, here it is.
I flew to San Francisco last week and found myself having a disconcertingly intimate experience with the good folks at TSA. Since I'm anticipating the same sort of overly exuberant greeting at Christmas, I thought I would write this little ditty about it. Flew home for Christmas, braved security. There were lines and warning signs, and one hard choice for me. Groped or irradiated and naked? Tough decision. At Christmas Eve, you'll find me with a gloved hand between my thighs. I'll be groped for Christmas and stripped by prying eyes. I'm stuck in line for Christmas. TSA, you see. No Santa Claus, just a fat agent's parts wandering all over me. And he didn't even offer to buy me dinner first. At Christmas Eve, you'll find me with a gloved hand between my thighs. I'll be groped for Christmas and stripped by prying, stripped by prying, stripped by prying, prying eyes, prying eyes, prying eyes. Ooh, prying eyes. Merry Christmas, TSA.
And that's Roxy Copeland, I'll Be Groped for Christmas, the TSA edition. You're tuned to Free Radio, 101.1 FM, www.freakradio.org. I'm Robert Norris. This is Bathrop's Pierre's Broadsides, the final 15 or 13 minutes. I encourage you to get in touch immediately if you want to be on the air, 427-3772, because we are rapidly winding down here, and about to leave the show. Before we do, though, let's hear some more interviews from the Civic Auditorium. Earlier today, there was a big meal there, not as big, probably about a third or a half as big as the veterans' meal last year, but it was put together very rapidly. Compliments of a number of people inspired by, I have to admit it, the infamous Steve Plaich, a city council member who should have won but didn't.
You would like a free radio?
May I have a free radio?
I don't even have a radio myself, but I have a tape recorder. That's about
an XM radio.
I'll keep that in mind.
For Christmas.
Indeed. Christmas is coming and going, as usual.
Happy Thanksgiving.
Thank you, man.
I realize that.
I got my machine working here.
May I talk about you?
So, you were saying before, your name again is?
LMA Wise.
Of course. And
I'm just saying that people have been putting this homeless band on for 5 years, I know of.
The sleeping band.
Yeah, I've been in the first one, a couple hours, second one. If they would sit together, they'd probably get somewhere. They don't want to sit together, they want to regulate who sleeps here, who sleeps there. Oh. It's about sleeping, where you sleep and where you can't sleep, so.
Actually, you can't sleep anywhere legally, well, according to the sleeping band.
So when people start being bosses that are also where they can't sleep, that's not sticking together. And they'd probably get further if they would sit together, honestly.
What do you think should
and
be done?
And pack their trash.
And pack their trash. Anything that, you know, you suggest they do to help this happen? Or?
You know, when I was first out here, and I was getting tickets all the time, they're pretty lenient now compared to when I was getting tickets.
Really?
You see people sleeping everywhere, everywhere, everywhere. And the bridge, they have tents up. We lived in the bridge. We were out.
Why doesn't the city maybe designated an area, a field, with portable potties? I mean, because
that'd be great.
You know, that would help out everybody.
If they would pack their own trash and maybe give the city some seriously, they're going to take care of the place, maybe. So they're bitching about something. That
I don't know if there is a real solution.
Not sleeping, but they're
always
not shooting June. Nothing.
Just babbling about it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, yeah. I think I agree with you. I think there should be a law that says don't litter.
No.
Yeah.
But
not a law that says don't sleep. You know, that's
well, exactly.
That makes sense. Absolutely.
So people are homeless out here that's saying, oh, you guys are harassing me, harassing me, harassing me. But to give them a reason to harass them, not packing their trash, just not, you know, sticking together and doing a homeless van, being homeless and one little like homeless family, you know.
And we've been talking with
LMA Weiss.
Thank you, LMA.
You know, I come out here and hit my friends stuff like that, you know?
We're chatting with the infamous
Dream Catcher.
And Dream, your catcher, DC, your Michael, whatever. You're here. Have you had your meal yet? Have you enjoyed yourself?
No, I'm still full from the last 3 days.
I see. I heard there was meals Tuesday and Wednesday, and this is Thursday, of course, so.
I kind of went hungry yesterday.
Actually, you went hungry? You didn't go to the beach flats to get the Second Salvation Army shindig?
No, I didn't.
Well, you know, you will be able to eat at least twice a year. That's the guarantee of the charity people who provide these meals. Actually, you can go out to the homeless service center, I suppose, and get food generally every day. But don't try to take a piss out there today. Apparently, they've closed down the restrooms.
Is that right?
I don't know if it's right, but I think it's what I've been told is the case.
That is not right, then.
No, it doesn't sound good. But it sounds kind of like typical, like when the homeless protest was here, they closed the restrooms at City Hall. Now, apparently they don't mind. They want you to fertilize the plants.
And they gave us good lighting to do it, too, remember?
Oh, yes, Klieg lights. I remember that very well.
This, of course, is a reference to the fact that in order to drive away homeless protesters who were sleeping outside City Hall, they set up high-intensity spotlights and shined them on the protesters throughout the night. And then set up a diesel-operated generator, a noisy diesel-operated generator, that also had a certain fume quotient as well, in order to, I guess they claimed it was for security in the area, but in fact it had to do with, quite clearly it had to do with making it inhospitable for people who wanted to protest. Then they decided to close down the area at night by edict. They tried to do that before, some years ago, and the court said they couldn't, but they, in the intervening period, they passed a law that allows the Parks and Rec director to close areas of the city that the Parks and Rec manages if she consults with the Parks and Rec Commission. But Danette Shoemaker, the head of the Parks and Rec, did not consult, but she still closed the areas. Apparently she did consult with the police, acting police chief Kevin Vogel, new city manager Martine Bernal, and of course outgoing mayor Mike Rotkin. A lot of pressure was put on the political protesters, again, who now face the courts and the possibility of many months in jail and thousands of dollars of fines. I wrote a flyer about it, which I think I'll read. Homeless man faces 6 months in jail. And this is the guy who actually decided to set up the protest table today outside the Civic Auditorium. Peace Camp 2010 goes to jury trial for protest sleep demonstration. First homeless sleep, now protesting bad law, is a crime in Santa Cruz. Long-term time activist and van dweller Michael Liebeck, also known as Crow, goes to jury trial 9 a.m. December 6th in Department 1 for sleeping outside in the county building in a protest demonstration with 50 others. For more than a month this summer, Peace Camp 2010, a coalition of housed and homeless activists, gave a safe place to sleep to dozens of homeless people in front of the county building. Throughout August and September, peaceful protesters kept a nightly vigil at City Hall, demanding the city change the sleeping ban, as Los Angeles and other cities have. They were met with new all-night Klieg lights, as I just mentioned, harassment citations for obstructing and lying down, and then new regulations closing City Hall and the library benches at night, which bypassed, as I mentioned before, the Parks and Recs Commission as required by law. More than 25 Peace Camp demonstrators faced the same unlawful lodging charge that Liebeck Crow does for sleeping outdoors on public property. It's actually simply a way of trying to end the protest, which it didn't really do. People continued protesting. Well, they moved from the county building to the City Hall, then briefly back to the county building, then back briefly to City Hall. What ended the protest was the decision that attorney Ed Fry, who was bringing the porta potty every night, had to realized he had to start devoting his resources to the legal situation. He was not only an activist, he was his own attorney and attorney for five other protesters. To my chagrin, I wish those five protesters got another attorney, because they need, first of all, to have more resources. Ed needs to have more time, but, well, who listens to Uncle Robert these days? New laws mean selective enforcement and more jail for the homeless. Under new laws passed in January and again in July of this year, the city council, and by the Santa Cruz City Council, unpaid sleep citations can now lead to jail for other crimes. Crimes are in quote, such as sitting on a bench for more than an hour, sitting near a building downtown, or holding up a need food sign at night. These are all illegal activities in Santa Cruz. And now if you do them after you've got three unpaid sleeping tickets, then you can be charged with you can actually go to jail for these new activities, like sitting on a bench for more than an hour. Small improvements in the modified sleeping ban still do not require the police to warn homeless people nor check to see if a shelter bed is available before ticketing them. Santa Cruz has a nighttime and vehicular sleeping ban and walk-in emergency shelter for less than 15% of its homeless population. The rest face $97 citations at the whim of a curious cop, a hostile politician, or a bigoted local with a cell phone. Acting Police Chief Kevin Vogel's police issued over 80 sleep citations to crush the protest, in addition to the 40 misdemeanor tickets for lodging, I might say. And there are more than 40. I think there were about 60, but I think only 25 to 40 have appeared in court. Seized homeless property was locked up but left outside in the rain by the police in the back of the Santa Cruz Police Department. I found that out when I went to retrieve tables, signs, and chairs that the police had first refused on two occasions to give me access to. City Council in closed session authorized another 8 cops and a private security guard downtown to deal with homeless crimes as the repression deepens. Merchant paranoia means wasted money and less cops for violent crime. Attorney and activist Ed Fry is himself facing jail for solidarity sleeping with the protesters. He provided the only nighttime bathroom facility, as I mentioned, a rented porta potty, in the city, not just at the protest, but there was no place other than this porta potty for homeless people to take a dump at night, or for housed people to take a dump unless they knew somebody or were making a purchase or were going into some private area. There is no public bathroom that's open at night in Santa Cruz. Each misdemeanor trial under 647E, which is the misdemeanor lodging law, can cost the county up to $20,000, probably more. This is the first of a dozen trials to punish homeless people and their housed supporters for visibly exposing the sleeping situation. Support Crow and the Peace Camp 2010 Fight Against the Sleeping Ban. Contact Ed Fry at 479-8911. That's 479-8911. Or Huff at 423-HUFF, H-U-F-F, 4833, 423-4833. Report police harassment or shelter stonewalling to Huff. And, of course, call into Free Radio. I do a show twice weekly, Thursday nights, 6 to 8, and Sundays, 9:30 to 1. And also demand D.A. Bobley drop the charges against sleep felons and call him at 454-2400. And that's about it for tonight, folks. Coming up next is Uncle Dennis's Thanksgiving special, which, as I mentioned to you, is going to be taped or audioed. He won't be in the studio. He's presumably off somewhere gobbling turkey or perhaps a vegetarian substitute. It doesn't involve murder of sentient creatures. So we'll hear more from Uncle Dennis next week from 8 to 11 on his normal show. And you'll hear more from me on Sunday, unless I find something better to do, which is an ever-present possibility, from 9:30 to 1. If you have any reports or you want to be a part of actions that will help to end the sleeping ban and end the criminalization of the homeless, hey, we need your help. The number to call, again, is 423-HUFF, 423-HUFF. 4833. The Huff website is down. Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom has a website that's been down for about a week and a half. And normally people who listen to this show or can't listen to it but want to can go to the archives by going to the Huff website. You can't do that. You can, however, go to the archives directly. But to do that, you'll have to call me at the Huff phone number and get all the secret information, and I will give it to you. 423-HUFF. I just don't have the time to do it, and it's not really convenient to do it over the air. It's a long web address, and I'll be happy to give it to anybody who wants to check out this show or any past shows during the time when the Huff website is down. Thanks for being with me in this edition of Bathrop Spears Broadsides, if you were. Nobody called in, so I'm pretty much alone here on Gobble Gobble Day. But I enjoyed doing the show anyway. So I hope you enjoyed listening. Now you get to hear Uncle Dennis's Thanksgiving special.
Welcome to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.1 and www.freakradio.org. I'm Uncle Dennis, and welcome to a special Thanksgiving version of From the Cream to the Dregs. No, I won't be in the studio tonight. I'll be with my family and friends. But if you're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz, I want to present you with this special show. So stay tuned for the next 3 hours. Let's start off with the Dixie Dregs.